It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our next guest digs deep into the causes of violent behavior and says our moral belief systems are often the driving force.
First, it's been less than a month since the documentary series Making a Murderer debuted on Netflix, but in that short time, it's generated a lot of buzz around the nation and tells the story of Stephen Avery, who in 2005 was convicted of killing Teresa Halbach in Manitowoc County. And the series raises many questions about how that case was handled.
Well, the series has been criticized by some for being one-sided and leaving out certain pieces of evidence that supported Avery's conviction, hasn't stopped outraged viewers from speaking out. People are signing petitions asking for a pardon of Stephen Avery by the thousands. In addition, the filmmakers say that a juror from Avery's 2005 murder case supposedly reached out to them to say he or she believed Avery was framed by law enforcement.
Here with us now to talk more about what's been going on since the series was released is Bruce Vilmedi. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers legal affairs. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, I don't know if anyone expected the huge reaction from this series. Can you describe what it's been, especially in the last week or two?
Well, I'd even go back a little further. I had written a very small item before the series was released, about a week before, I think, where I just noted that the trailer was now available. You know, because before we had done stories that the series was coming, but there's really nothing to see about it. So it was a short item noting the trailer was available, and I linked to the trailer. That first weekend after the series was released, I got nasty emails from people who thought I wasn't on their side enough in just promoting the fact the trailer was available. And that's kind of when I first got, in fact, one of these people said they were going to feed me to Reddit, which is the online community where people were discussing it already, if I didn't sort of do the right thing and write another story about, you know, how he was framed, I guess.
Wow. So people were on board with it already, tracking it well before it was released. So is that, do you put that down to the ground efforts of the filmmakers? Were they already creating a big community online, or has this case been kind of active since it happened?
Oh, no, I mean, this happened as soon as it had been released, the weekend it got released. Obviously, people watched it immediately. Is what I meant. As soon as they saw it, they went back and were looking for everything that had been written about.
Gotcha.
And they found even this short brief promoting it. It was really what I was doing, was saying, hey, you may think you're tired of this story if you're from Wisconsin, but based just on the trailer, you might get interested again. And sure, we are very interested again, I guess.
So that's happened. What else have you seen?
Well, I think in just the short time, it's my recollection of it. I did another story. I did do a follow-up story about the initial buzz that I think ran the day after Christmas, and it's continued growing, obviously. And I think my interest in it is, I'm interested in more of it as a TV phenomenon, I think, more than a legal phenomenon, because, I mean, I've covered and gone to many, many, many trials in a long career of being a journalist, and I think to people who are familiar with it, you realize that, you know, almost every case has got its flaws. And that many cases, people are convicted anyway, and we know that a lot of those convictions are wrongful, as, you know, Avery's initial conviction proved. But what I'm more interested in just how it's become this massive phenomenon online, and it says, like, who would have thought this was something that's on a very limited, not everyone gets Netflix. And I think some of the national commentators are starting to make these observations now. There's one in the LA Times today that says, you know, this is really about your audience. You know, that buzz really shows the power of a compelling narrative and the importance of knowing your audience, and points out that the audience, though we think it's everybody, is really more limited than you would think. It's people who, one, get Netflix and have the time to watch the 10 hours and then the time to be outraged and write about it.
So given that, given all of what you just said, why do you think it is resonating so much with the people who watch it on Netflix?
Because I think it must be, and here's my full disclosure, I meant to say this up front, I have not watched the entire thing yet. I've seen the trailer. But I can tell just from the reaction, it's phenomenally done. And I mean, even some of the people I talked to early in that first week who were, you know, subject of a lot of criticism in the piece admit it's very skillfully done and obviously has a great impact on viewers. Not only getting them to watch 10 hours in a row, but then to follow up by, you know, writing to their congressman and making phone calls to Manitowoc and harassing the lawyers they don't like and, you know, making marriage proposals to the lawyers they do like, that kind of stuff. It's just powerful. And I think it just shows you how, you know, film or video editing can be still one of our most compelling mediums out there.
Now, one ongoing point of conversation has some viewers saying that the series is told expressly from the point of view of the defense, according to those people who think that, and not the prosecution. How is that topic unfolding?
I think the people who are convinced by watching the whole thing that he was framed and is innocent are convinced of that because of the power of the piece. And I think that the fact that they reacted so strongly suggests it does short shrift, and more and more people are now coming out to detail the kind of pieces of the story that are omitted or given only, surface treatment in the documentary. And I'm not faulting the documentary. The filmmakers are out to make a hit film, and they did. So I think it's clear that, a conspiracy story, that kind of narrative, is a much more compelling kind of a program to watch than something that's a traditional, super balanced, dry documentary.
We're talking right now to Bruce Valmetti from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers legal affairs, talking about the Netflix hit Making of a Murderer, which is getting bigger and bigger right now. And in fact, this year we've seen petitions, or last couple of weeks, I should say, petitions starting on change.org, whitehouse.gov, with the goal of getting a pardon for Stephen Avery and for his nephew. And these petitions have been getting hundreds of thousands of signatures. Is that likely to convince anyone in this case to take a second look?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think there are some people who have believed, and from what I've seen so far, I tend to lean that possibly Dassey would get a new trial out of this because he's got the pending habeas petition right now in federal court here in Milwaukee. It raises a lot of the same complaints about his lawyer's work for him that were already once rejected by the State Court of Appeals. But, different audience, this is a federal magistrate who's considering it, may view it differently. I'm not sure that necessarily will get him a different outcome unless his effort, which was done by his lawyers, even the lawyers that come off the worst in the documentary, Mr. Kaczynski, they did try to suppress his initial confession, which was the most damning thing against him. If he got a new trial and somehow a different judge were to suppress that, then it's a different ballgame. He could, but I don't, for Avery, I honestly wouldn't like to see it, because that almost suggests that anyone who can get a lot of public outrage over their case can get a new trial or get released from prison. And I think I'd like to rather trust the legal system. Even though we know it has flaws, I think I'd rather trust that than just popular opinion.
Now, we've had a lively conversation about this going on over on the Central Time Facebook page, and a listener earlier in the day posted an article that made the point that the death of Teresa Halbach was getting lost in this big media circus, and that a human life was lost here in a horrible way.
Has her
family spoken out about the series at all?
I tried to leave a message for her brother when I did this follow-up story around Christmas time. Didn't get a response, and I have not seen them talking about this anywhere. I think they made a statement ahead of the series release, knowing it was coming and probably assuming the tack it was going to take, and said what you'd expect them to say. It's just horrible that people are making entertainment and a profit off our tragedy, and it's hard to disagree with that. Although, on the other hand, I don't dispute why. I understand why people find it fascinating, and I'm sure it's a very super compelling piece of work, as evidenced by the people who've watched it 10 hours straight and then taken steps to express their outrage.
I understand that the New York Post has gone so far as to suggest that Manitowoc County is now a tourist destination, that people are going there, taking pictures of places that they believe to be affiliated, shown this documentary series. Is that actually happening based on what you've seen?
I've heard that. I've not seen it, but I have colleagues who say they've seen the pictures. And, it's kind of odd because in the beginning, we thought, oh my God, this is what does the Chamber of Commerce think in Manitowoc County? They're looking like the worst kind of Mississippi during Jim Crow or whatever, as a place of corruption and prejudice. And now, I think just before we came on, there was a story about the demands for the records from the clerk's office there. And I read one where a person in Australia was willing to pay the $6,000 copying costs to get all this stuff. So, maybe they sell that a few times and people come as tourists. In the end, it winds up being a benefit. I don't know. I think the people involved, know what they know, and it's they don't enjoy this kind of attention that paints them in a pretty bad light. And if, and the fact is, they did make a lot of mistakes in the case. There were a lot of things they could have done better. And but whether that means he's innocent, you know, or framed, or will get out, that remains to be seen.
Well, Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Bruce Valmetti, legal affairs reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the latest buzz surrounding the series Making a Murderer.
When we see violence in the news, terror attacks in Paris or California, the rising number of shootings in Milwaukee, stories of domestic violence, we might wonder what kind of person would do such a thing. There's often an assumption that the perpetrator was lacking a moral code. They were sadistic or psychopathic, or they had that moral code but lost their grip. They acted on impulse.
But our next guest says that many violent acts are seen by the perpetrator as upholding their moral code, their vision of what society should be. Far from being seen as an immoral act or a mistake in judgment, violence is seen as a necessary, even a positive action, despite all the harm that can be done. And he says that if we don't understand the causes of violence, it's going to be very difficult to reduce violence in the future.
Tage Rye joins us now. He's a postdoctoral research associate and lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's co-author of the book Virtuous Violence, Hurting and Killing to Create, Sustain, End, and Honor Social Relationships. Tage, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as we mentioned, it's tempting to think of perpetrators of, say, a violent crime as a villain or a sadist or a psychopath. You're right, that happens, but it's not really the norm, is it?
No, I mean, I think everyone wants to live in a world where perpetrators know that what they're doing is wrong and then they do it anyway. But that's just not really the world we live in. So, you know, we can think about sadists, we can think about psychopaths, and actually they just account for really less than 10% of violence around the world. So then we have to ask the question, what motivates the rest of us? And at least in our book, when we look across history, across cultures, what we find is that most perpetrators of violence really fundamentally believe that what they're doing is the right thing, or at least that's what they feel deep to their core.
Right. And before we dig deeper into that, I think another assumption, as we mentioned, is that this might have been a decent person. They had a lapse. They were angry. They had a momentary lapse of reason, and that led them to do this thing. And again, you say, no, that the evidence doesn't seem to point to that either. So ideas of if we just had more self-control, we'd have less violence. Maybe that wouldn't pan out.
Sure. I mean, academics have known for a long time that most killers aren't really sadistic or psychopathic. And so then the argument has been that, well, they know that what they're doing is wrong, but they just do it anyway, either because they gave in to temptation or because of a momentary lapse. So somebody had a tough day at work, they get frustrated, they take it out on their partner, even though they know it's wrong. What we find is that although that may happen, that in itself isn't really a good explanation. So the fact that I was upset still doesn't give me an answer into why was I upset in the first place.
Right.
So that makes sense. That, in other words, a lot of our theories really focus on how the conditions that keep us from being violent, things like self-control, empathy, how those things break down, but they don't get at the other side of the equation of why did I want to hurt somebody in the first place.
And so why? And you started to touch on that a few moments ago. We feel when we commit an act of violence, whether it's something that's later regarded as crime or a heroic act if we're defending our fellow soldiers in war, in all those cases, for the most part, we think we're doing something right, morally right, or maintaining a social order, you write.
Yes, that's essentially true, that when we look at what perpetrators say, when we look at historical documents, when we look at ethnographies, when we look at observations of war, of genocide, of initiation rites, of spousal abuse, of any kind of violence you can come up with, what we see are people who think that their violence is both right and obligatory, that to not be violent would be seen as morally wrong in their eyes.
So let's spell it out. In a case like maybe when we think of an inner city shooting or an act of domestic violence, the perpetrator is thinking what? That something has been done, some offense that has been done to them, and to make things right, they have to react violently?
Potentially, in those cases. So sometimes, if we look at the inner city gang case, it's going to be retaliation. Something has been done to them. They need to do something back. Oftentimes, something was done to their group. Now that entitles them to attack somebody in the other group. A lot of times that violence, though, may be part of initiation. As part of joining the group, you need to attack some other group. we can look at something like you brought up spousal abuse just now. There, the motivations are still going to be moral, but might take a different flavor. Perhaps the in most cases, the husband thinks that his wife is or partner is a legitimate subordinate, and she's disrespecting his authority. Therefore, he feels that it's his place to attack her and you know, discipline her in that sense.
Well, Tate, I mean, this is pretty disturbing in a way, because there's this really positive element of being a human, our social connectedness, and yet in these cases and so many others, we're turning that social connectedness that makes us human into a justification for violence.
That's right. I mean, when we say that violence is morally motivated, there's this question of, well, what is it morally motivated toward? And what it's motivated toward is regulating the kinds of important social relationships in all of our lives. Oftentimes, we're going to be able to regulate those relationships through nonviolent means. And so then the question is, how do we get people who are regulating through violent means to shift toward regulating in nonviolent ways? If you end up hitting my dog with your car, I could come up to you and talk to you about it and perhaps call the authorities and get your license revoked, or I could pull out a gun and shoot you. How do we shift people from one option to the other?
We're talking to Tage Rye. He researches the causes of violence. He's the co-author of the book Virtuous Violence, Hurting and Killing to Create, Sustain, End, and Honor Social Relationships. And Tage, I want to run with that last point you brought up. Obviously, in most societies, the goal is to reduce the amounts of violence, to reduce violent crime. We've already talked about maybe self-control, boosting self-control isn't the answer given the causes. So if there's this fundamental idea that people feel that they're doing the right thing when they commit violent crimes, how do you change that? It's not just changing that person in that case, is it?
No, I mean, if we look at violence, we know that, you know, if we look at something like gun violence, it's often caused by people in cases where people are socially disadvantaged and when they're coming from communities where gun violence is condoned. So that means that we have to approach it by both giving people other opportunities to gain respect, to gain legitimacy through nonviolent means. So all the sorts of social structural approaches to changing that social disadvantage, giving people jobs, giving people homes. And then to also support the kinds of community interventions that leverage third-party relationships of perpetrators so that the people that perpetrators care about, can force them toward nonviolence, right? To show them that they believe and they feel that violence is wrong, that it is hurting their relationships within the broader community.
Well, let's turn this to the problem of terrorism now. A terrorist in this model feels like it'd be morally wrong not to take violent action in many cases for offenses done to the Muslim community in some cases, in Northern Ireland, to the Catholic or Protestant communities in years past, a lot of non-religious reasons too. So how can a community change the mindset of people so that they don't view violence as a moral imperative, as a moral right action?
I mean, there's a lot of layers to the question of terrorism. One is about how do you get it off the ground, and then once it's going, how do you stop it? If we look at terrorists, a lot of times they really are not just hating the West and trying to combat them. They're also trying to join into a particular group. They're trying to be part of something. They're trying to get meaning in their lives. So this means we need to provide people with alternative ways of meaning that they can find within those communities. It also means that if many of them are being motivated by a sense of retaliation, then we need to make sure that that gets quelled at the beginning. So, you know, if we look at something like the rise of ISIS, we have this question of, well, where did it come from? And if we think about the fact that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi noncombatant civilians died during the Iraq War, then we have to ask the question whether if any fraction of those deaths led people to radicalize, and if so, then that multiplies the number of terrorists tenfold.
And I think it was in your piece I read that there can be value in respected members of a community really trying to set standards, maybe new standards or maybe revising old standards, to make it clear to members of their own community that that violence is not a moral act. Is that something that can make a difference, whether we're talking about international terrorism or violence in an American city?
Sure. If we look at gang violence interventions. You can look at work by David Kennedy in Baltimore, I think, where they've really focused on developing these kinds of interventions that enable killers to be confronted by members of their communities in the face of, you know, coupled with potential material consequences by police, to show them that actually, in fact, their violence isn't supported. And that when you do that, when you have those kind of community-based interventions, the effectiveness is much stronger than when we try to add material consequences purely alone. And that makes sense, because we're getting more and more work to suggest that if someone's motivated to kill by non-material moral benefits, then they're not going to respond to material costs like going to jail in the same way that someone who's just killing for money would.
Tage, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Tage Rye from MIT. His piece on violence, by the way, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Traditional markers of adulthood are getting a job, getting married, having kids, maybe buying a house. But Americans are getting married later or not at all, and they're waiting longer to have children, too. A recent report from Zillow shows first-time homebuyers are waiting longer than ever before to move from renting to owning. With all these societal changes, when do you really become an adult?
What do you think defines adulthood? What marks that transition? When did you really feel like you became an adult, or you still feel like you're not quite grown up yet? Call in and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Julie Beck joins us now. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and she writes about health and psychology. You can find a link to her piece, When Are You Really an Adult, on the Central Time Facebook page. And she joins us from studios at The Atlantic. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, like we mentioned there, we have this traditional idea, almost this leave it to beaver idea of what it means to be an adult. You've got your marriage, your kids, buying a house. Where did that all come from?
It's really interesting. I do like to call it the leave it to beaver markers. And it's funny because they really only ever all arrived for somebody, you know, in a relatively short period of time, for a couple of decades right after World War II. So, you know, people still want those things. You know, people still want to get married or have kids, you know, buy a house, you know, depending on who it is. But these things are happening later and later. But we're just comparing it to this, you know, pretty anomalous time in our history when, you know, the economy was really prospering. And a lot of times people didn't even need, you know, a high school diploma to get a job that could support a family, which is very rarely the case these days. So when we're saying, you know, people are taking longer to grow up because they're not getting these things, they're waiting too long to sort of achieve these roles, we're really only comparing them to a pretty unfair yardstick.
Now, we hear about this all the time in association with millennials, that the economy is bad, so they don't have the financial stability, say, to buy a house or maybe even to get married. But you said this really wasn't the norm except for the post-World War II era. So what other generations have struggled with this besides millennials?
Yeah, I mean, so this is, I talked to, you know, a historian of adulthood who was really the one who was saying, you know, it's really only after World War II that people had these things so quickly. And even before that, you know, in the 19th century, that really wasn't the case. A lot of times young men would have to wait for their fathers to die to get married so they could get their inheritance. And, you know, hopefully people who are getting married later today are doing it for, like, slightly less morbid reasons than that. And, you know, I mentioned as an example in my piece, Henry Thoreau, the famous writer, he, you know, moved back in with his parents after he graduated from Harvard and then moved out and then moved back in again and cycled through jobs for like 12 years.
Crashed with a friend.
Yeah, crashed with his buddy Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I mean, even relatively successful people from the past were living in this way.
Does that mean we may have these unrealistic ideas, these sort of out of the... not really the pages of history, but I guess the pages of television or popular imagination about adulthood that are really not what it means to be an adult today?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, a certain veneration of that era. I mean, you know, they call people, you know, the greatest generation, and people who have seen that modeled either in their own families or through media, as you said, may have this idea in their mind that that's what it means to be an adult, and you take on all these roles, you know, maybe within the couple years after you graduate or move out of your parents' house, and then boom, you're an adult. But for a lot of people, it really doesn't work that way.
Well, looking at what it means to be an adult, you dug into some different definitions, legal, religious, and biological. Let's start with legal. Legally, is there anything that's going to help us out here when we are trying to talk about what it means to be an adult?
It's funny because I wanted to try and find, you know, the simplest possible definition of the boundary between childhood and adulthood. And I was like, okay, let's just start with the law. And you would say, okay, you're an adult at 18. But, like, not really. You know, you get certain adult responsibilities at 18. You can vote. You can join the military. But you can't drink till you're 21. And by the time you're 18, you know, you're already allowed to watch adult movies. And you can hold a job in many states as young as 14. And so even within the realm of the law, whether you're an adult depends on the responsibility that you're talking about.
Well, what about religion, which might offer different coming of age ceremonies that maybe in the past would have been sort of a more clear marker of, yes, now you are a man or a woman?
Yeah, I mean, there are coming-of-age ceremonies that people still do go through, you know, bar and bat mitzvahs, Catholic confirmations. A quinceañera is not really a religious ceremony, I don't think, but, you know, it's a coming-of-age ceremony that someone might have. But, again, that only gives you adulthood within certain realms. You know, once you're 13 and you've had a bar mitzvah, that doesn't mean you can go vote. You know, there's still restrictions in other areas of culture.
And then lastly, let's look at biology here. I mean, that seems kind of the most logical. You look at body and brain here. Is there evidence that we can point a finger and say, yep, that's adulthood?
Yeah, once again, I was looking for the simple answer that I couldn't find. I mean, you can say, you know, once you're sexually mature, you're mature, but that's, you know, problematic because if you're, you know, 14, 15 and you're done with puberty, like, that people aren't going to say that you're, you know, old enough to have a relationship with an adult. And as far as brain goes, you know, there's a lot of different areas that develop, and it again depends on what you're talking about, because the brain scientist I was talking to was saying, you know, your logical reasoning is pretty much developed by 16, and so he thinks, you know, there shouldn't be any reason why 16-year-olds can't vote. Their logic is perfectly good, but the connections that kind of help you control your impulsivity and things like that are not fully developed, and so that comes later, sometimes even into the early 20s.
We're talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic right now, talking about the question, what makes an adult? And another term that you looked into, which is maybe a little more helpful when we try to think about what makes an adult, especially today when a lot of the markers that we think of as denoting adulthood are hard to come by. And this is the concept of emerging adulthood, sort of that it's this phase of years where you're sort of growing into yourself. Explain what that means.
Yeah, so that's a new life stage that has been named by Jeffrey Jensen Arnett, and so there's some debate over whether it is a new life stage. You know, when you're, you know, 18 to 25 or 18 to 29, sometimes they'll say that this is a new life stage where you are not quite, you're not an adolescent anymore, but you're working up to being an adult. Some people would just say that adolescence has been extended to go into the early 20s, and that has a lot to do with, you know, people taking on roles later, as you said, but it also has a lot to do with people's subjective evaluations as to whether they are an adult or not. You know, if they just don't feel like an adult, then can we call them one?
Do other people buy into that idea of emerging adulthood?
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten a lot of coverage, and I think, you know, I'm certainly not the one to say whether it's a life stage or whether it's not, but it is an interesting concept because I think it recognizes a lot of both the societal things that are happening and the way people are thinking about adulthood for themselves.
Well, it's an interesting topic because it, without these markers that we're talking about, if you threw those out, it really comes down to how you feel. Do you feel like an adult? And then the question is, what makes you feel like an adult? And you asked people this. You got some opinions. What kinds of things did people tell you?
Yeah, we put out a call to readers, and we got really just a huge variety of responses. everybody seems to have, you know, different moments that they kind of realized for themselves, or it was just a creeping sensation that kind of came upon them slowly. So the only, you know, themes of things that I saw over and over again were two things. One was having kids, and one was the loss of a parent. And so those two seem to be really like flip the switch moments for people, but a lot of times it's a lot more gradual than that.
Right, and some people were resentful over the notion that you had to have kids to be an adult. I think there was a quote that I read where a friend's father told one person who was commenting to you, you never really grew up, and it was basically because she hadn't had kids. And so there are all these assumptions about what kids do to you, and it might be that you feel like an adult, and it might be that they don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very fraught issue, you know. Everybody wants to have opinions on whether or not other people should have kids. But I think I would never say that you have to have kids to be an adult. I think that a lot of people who do have kids feel that that was a very defining moment for them. And this is just me sort of interpreting the letters that I received. But it seems for a lot of other people, moving into a caretaking role for a parent can also be that kind of moment. Or, you know, it comes upon you in incremental stages, and you don't, you know, one day go into the hospital and come out with someone you're responsible for. But that doesn't mean that these same processes and a growing up is not happening in other ways.
Did you ever think about whether maybe there really is no such thing as being an adult, that our self-conception sort of freezes early on, and that's just what it is, and there is no such thing as adulthood, really?
Oh, I mean, adulthood is completely, you know, a social construct. As, you know, I was saying, if you try and break it down into actual things that can be measured in terms of, you know, biology or psychology or brain science, there's a million different measures that you can choose, and you'll get something different every time. So, I mean, but it's a construct that's important because it determines, you know, what responsibilities we let people take on in society. It determines how we view each other and how we view ourselves. But that doesn't mean it's not something we totally made up.
We're talking to Julie Beck right now from The Atlantic, talking about what it means to be an adult when you know.
And we want to hear your thoughts on this now at 800-642-1234. When did you first feel like an adult? Was there a moment, an event, a transition in your life, or you're still waiting? What is it going to take to make you feel grown up? What do you think makes people be an adult? Why do you think the line between childhood and adulthood feels so blurry these days? When do you think of your kids as adults, if ever? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with Atlantic editor Julie Beck about what it really means to be an adult.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your definition of an adult? When do you think people make that transition from childhood or teenhood to adulthood? What made you feel like you'd taken that step? You're an adult now. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our phones now and take our first call from Laura in Madison. Laura, hi.
Oh, hi. Hey, I heard a show on National Public Radio last year about this topic, and I'd love your guests' take on it. The people they had on that show said there were three criteria that you have to be an adult. You have to stop depending on your parents financially, so you provide for yourself completely financially. You have to go out into the world and see the world without your parents' lens and form some opinions about the world that are uniquely yours, that are different from those of your parents. So those are the first two. Mm-hmm. You have to be financially independent of your parents and intellectually independent of your parents. The third one, they said, was the hardest one for people, and that is to no longer need your parents to be the perfect role models, to be perfect archetypes, to be all-knowing and all-powerful and all-loving, and to recognize that they're just human beings, they make mistakes, and to forgive them for that and to relate to them as people and try to develop an adult relationship with them that doesn't involve, you know, old resentments. And
Laura, thank you so much for those thoughts that you heard. Those are interesting points there. What do you think about those, Julie?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I would love to hear that show. So it reminds me, it's pretty similar to when the psychologist who studies emerging adulthood who coined that term, when he was doing interviews with people about whether they felt like an adult or not, there were three things that came up for them repeatedly, which are not quite exactly the same but similar, which are financial independence, so that one is the same, and then feeling like you've taken responsibility for your actions and feeling like you are independent. And a lot of those things are defined, in relation to your parents because, who are you financially independent from or what have you. I think the bit about sort of seeing your parents as people and not as, the perfect, all-powerful people who take care of you, I think that's really something. I think that comes up a lot for people, and especially in terms when people are talking about having to move into caretaking roles for parents, or when a parent dies and that making them feel a lot like an adult. I think that's coming from a similar place, where they see that they're the ones that have to take care of their parents, or they're the ones that have to take care of themselves.
Do you think having that first one, the financial one, and you talked about this too, obviously, in your piece, makes it difficult to be completely financially independent? Because in the economy today, you graduate at the wrong time, the job market is rough, the economy is rough. I mean, maybe by that yardstick, you're not an adult until you're 50 years old.
Well, maybe. I think that is something that's important to people. And some, reader letters that we got, people would say, well, I'm living with my parents, so I don't feel like I'm totally an adult yet. But a lot of times people will report that they feel like an adult in some ways and not in other ways. And I think, that's kind of, the sort of herky-jerky path to adulthood that a lot of people take is, you mature in some ways faster and in some ways slower. And some days you don't feel like an adult in a particular way, and some days you do. And I think it's part of the process.
We're talking to Julie Beck right now from The Atlantic Magazine, talking about how you know when you're an adult, what it takes to be an adult. And we'll go back to our phones now, take a call from Maggie in Janesville. Maggie, hi.
Hi. So I am glad that, Julie and you guys all got to talking about the financial independence aspect. For me, I graduated just a couple of years ago, and I have $50,000 in debt. And for some people, that's nothing compared to what they have. But for me, it's enough that it's crippling, and I cannot move out on my own right now. I've taken a job in Brookfield, and I live in Janesville, so commuting is cheaper than trying to live on my own.
So you have a job, and you graduated from college. Those are two important benchmarks. So, Maggie, do you feel like an adult despite that, or do you think the financial stuff is holding you back?
I think the financial stuff is holding me back. I'm definitely one of those people that if I could pay, my phone and my car insurance instead of my family having to, I surely would. And I want them to not have to carry that burden anymore, but I'm just not at that point yet.
Well, Maggie, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that. And Julie, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common story. And the financial thing has been pretty important for me in terms of feeling like I'm an adult. But I think there's still a sense of okay, yes, like I can pay for my life. I'm responsible for my life, and that's really great. But that's not to say that there aren't tons of ways in which I can still continue to grow up, and maybe need to still continue to grow up.
Appreciate that call, and we're gonna go next to Mark in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
What did you want to add?
It just made me think about right after I turned 30, I had this mentor that was kind of helping me through some rough patches in life, and I called him, and I said, I told him I had a realization, and that was that I can't have everything I want. And he said that was a pretty good realization to have. And I felt, after that, I just kind of felt like I was an adult, like I'd never felt like an adult before. And after that, I have felt like I've grown up. I just realized that, there were certain things about my life that I wanted to be different, and they can't always be. And just accepting that, I felt like I grew up.
Oh, that's great. Mark, thank you for that. Acceptance was really important to Mark, and knowing that he couldn't have everything he wanted, but that he accepted that, that's an interesting way to look at that. What do you think about that one, Julie?
Yeah, I think the realism can sometimes be important. Yeah, it's interesting. The emerging adulthood guy in his book was writing about how a lot of times for people, the 20s are a really hard decade, but they're also like very hopeful, and so people still think that I'm still living with my parents or I'm struggling in these ways, but I can definitely like still get that like shiny life that I want. And a lot of times, as he said, it's certain things just aren't possible, and that can be hard, but probably also a sort of growing up realization.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Mark, and we'll go next to Stan in Caledonia. Hi, Stan.
Hi. I was actually having this debate with my good friend Kyle on New Year's Eve, and we were talking about when we felt like we became an adult, because I told him that in many ways for me, it was when I had the financial independence where I didn't have to rely on my parents anymore. And Kyle was saying that in some way he felt like the government and the state had actually defined it to him, because when he was, I believe, 16 or 17, he had been charged as an adult because he got busted for having a fat bag of nuggets and had to go to jail as an adult.
Wow, so different experiences there. Stan, thanks a lot for sharing that. And so obviously you've got a legal thing tried as an adult. You probably feel quite a lot like an adult at that point. So Julie, what about some of those markers that are kind of, to coin a phrase, thrust upon us, like Hamlet says?
Yeah, the legal aspect is really, really interesting, because I think a lot of the brain science and things that I was talking about how certain impulsive connections aren't formed until later life is being considered by the legal system to sort of think about whether people should, for sentences for juveniles and whether they should be susceptible to life sentences. That was kind of referred to in a Supreme Court case from a few years ago. So they're looking at that and they're thinking about that. But a lot of times, so someone else that I interviewed for the piece, I was kind of going around asking all my sources, when is somebody really an adult? When is somebody really an adult? And he was like, well, the question that I would want to ask is, when is somebody really a child? Because a lot of times people are sort of forced into these adult roles and responsibilities or consequences that they maybe aren't ready for.
Let's go and take one more call here. Kurt is joining us from Wind Point. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I was just going to comment that this is in the 70s, when I moved to Key West, Florida, where my brother lived, and I left my childhood home to move down there, the very first time I ran out of toothpaste and had to then go buy toothpaste, that was the moment I knew I was an adult. I had never before bought any of that kind of stuff for myself. It just magically appeared in our home.
It was a toothpaste purchase for Kurt. Something, one of those moments that just hits you like a lightning bolt. Did a lot of people have answers like that, Julie? Just very specific, this moment.
Yeah, he reminds me very closely of someone who emailed and said that it was not when they bought their first pack of floss, but when they bought their second pack of floss, when it ran out and they were like, dang, I better buy another one. That's when it was really an adult.
Well, Julie, it's been fun. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was Julie Beck, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. We talked to her about what it really means to be an adult. You can find a link to her piece and share your story over on the Central Time Facebook page.